station at Manly Hot Springs. It should be a wireless station. In order to start this story about my adventure in Alaska and the Arctic correctly, I will have to begin from the time I first came to Alaska. In the spring of 1924, I was working on a road construction job on what was called the Montwood Loop Road in Oregon. There on the job, I met a fellow by the name of Ira Wiesner from Greensburg, Indiana. One day he asked me if I had ever dreamed of going to Alaska. I told him that it had been in my mind since I was a little kid, having heard so much about the Klondike and the gold. Well, Ira said, let's go to Seattle. I have heard that the Kennecott copper mines are hiring men to go to Alaska to work in the mines of Kennecott. That's out from Cordova. I said, I'm game. So we quit our jobs and went to Seattle. In order to save as much money as possible, we left Portland, Oregon on a freight train in a boxcar. Arriving in Seattle after getting a 75-cent room in a Japanese flophouse on First Avenue, we contacted the office of the Kennecott Copper Corporation. This office was located down on the skid road, not far from our hotel. The office man said that the only hiring we are doing now is for experienced miners, and they are hired on a 6-month basis. We will pay the fare up to the mine. This fare will be deducted from your first paycheck. But if the miner stays 6 months, the fare will be refunded. When the office man said experienced miners, I looked at Ira. Then I said, well, we're just the men you're looking for. We just came from a rock quarry job in Oregon, and we are both experienced jackhammer men and powder men, as close as either one of us had ever been to powder or jackhammers was watching somebody else using them. Well, we signed up. The pay was to be 60 cents per hour, 8 hours a day, 7 days a week. Then we had to pay $1.50 per day for board and room. We were to leave on the steamer Northwestern in a couple of days, but something came up and we did not depart for a week. We finally got started for Cordova, Alaska. Being landlubbers, both of us, we both got seasick on the trip. We traveled steerage, had our own blanket, slept in 3-story bunks, and I got one of the top bunks. All the stink from below came up to where I tried to sleep. This made me all the sicker. I ended up spending most of the time on deck and fed the fishes. The food on the boat was not too good, but I guess I would not have enjoyed even the best, the way I felt. The passengers were a mixed variety, Filipinos, Chinamen, Indians, and a lot of Scandinavians, all going to some fishing village or cannery in Alaska. I guess Ira and I were the only poor sailors of the bunch. Arriving in Cordova, we stayed at a hotel or boarding house operated by the Kennecott Copper Corporation. We were to leave on the Copper River and Northwestern Railroad the next morning. Our first stop on the trip was at Chitna, where we spent the night. The roadhouse keeper's name was Oscar Breedman. The next morning we started out for our final leg of the journey and arrived at Kennecott the same evening. We checked in at the main office at Kennecott after a trip to the company hospital for a checkup. We were assigned to the jumbo mine. We were hired as muckers. In order to reach jumbo mine, you had to ride the ore tramway 4 miles, seizing an empty ore bucket. The tram in places spanned gullies hundreds of feet in the air, and the ride was quite a thrill for us cheeseuckers. The tram would stop every so often as the buckets on the upper end were filled with copper ore and spaced evenly on the return cable. The full buckets being heavy and going downhill would pull the empty buckets up without power. All passengers and all the freight was transported to the mines in this manner. Special freight cars were also used on the cable for long timbers, etc., and other freight that did not fit in the ore bucket. There was a stop about halfway up the mountain. Here is where the junction of the Jumbo and the Bonanza trams join. In other words, it was a Y in the tramway. The two mines used the same cable from this point down to the mill at Kennecott. After our arrival at the Jumbo mine, we were assigned rooms. I was put in a room with 3 Italians. The room was small with 4 bunks, 2 uppers and 2 lowers. And as before, I drew a top bunk. But after about a month, one of the men left the mine and I got one of the lowers. This made it a lot better. Or in the other part of the bunkhouse, received the same treatment. I started work on the night shift on the 700-foot level. Worked as a mucker for about 2 months. Then, according to the record about my experiences in handling powder, I got a job bulldozing in the horseshoes. This job as a bulldozer at that time consisted of blasting loose ore hung up in the stoop in order for the ore to come down to the chute to be loaded in the tram cars. These cars ran on rails drawn by horses. I heard that the horses on the 700-foot level hadn't been in the mine for many, many years and were totally blind. Well, getting back to my job bulldozing, the man running the tram would report that chute number so-and-so, they were all numbered, was empty. The ore stuck someplace up in the stope. The bulldozer man would then move his equipment to the place. This included a stooper. This machine is powered by air and supported by a leg plate on the tunnel floor. The operator then, using whatever length of drill steel needed to plug real boulder or rock, stopping the ore from coming down. The loading of this, the hole is dangerous. At times you have to crawl up the chute in order to place your explosives. Another method used was to tie several sticks of dynamite in a bundle and tie the charge onto a 1x1-inch stick of lumber, light the fuse, and reach up in the stoop and place the charge between 2 boulders. Sometimes the rocks were stuck so far up that several 16-foot lumber sticks were tied together, end to end. the dozer man would have to estimate the time it would take to place the bundle of powder and cut the length of fuse accordingly. There is no allowance for mistakes in this operation, as I will mention. All the time that you are tying on the stick or on the second stick, or whatever length you require, the fuse is burning and getting closer to the powder. Things went on good for a couple of weeks. I had good luck in placing my shot and kept the ore coming. The raise in pay on this new job amounted to 10 cents per hour and 70 cents per hour those days was real good money. Then about 2 weeks on the new job, it happened. I was called to open a chute number 6 on 700 foot level. Looking up the chute, in parentheses, the chutes were made out of timber, set in solid rock with a gate, the opening about 4 feet by 4 feet. I could see at a glance what stopped the ore from coming down. Two large boulders side by side about 25 feet up in the scoop. There was a crack or opening between the boulders large enough, I estimated, to accommodate 4 or 5 sticks of powder. I tied 4 sticks onto one by one piece of lumber and 5 feet of fuse. I then let the fuse, pushed the whole thing up towards the boulders, tied on another stick of lumber, as the first one was too short to reach the spot where I wanted the powder. For some reason, the string holding the bundle onto this stick broke, maybe cut by a sharp rock, and the whole bundle, fuse and all, rolled down into the chute. I knew I did not have time to retie the powder and onto the stick. Here's where I made my mistake. Instead of pulling the fuse or cutting it, I picked up the bundle, fuse and all, and threw it as far up the stoop as I possibly could, hoping it would catch and hold someplace. Then I ran back into the tunnel. I did not make it back to the cross cut in the drift, and when the blast went off, the concussion knocked me down. I did not get hurt except for a slight ringing in my ears for several days after. When the smoke cleared in the drift, the whole tunnel in front of the chute was full of rocks and timbers. The whole chute was busted out. Luckily, the drift was a dead end and nobody beyond. The foreman came along and I thought, I guess my job as a miner is gone. But all he said was, you know, Axel, it has happened before and it will happen again. You'll get a gang of muckers and the timber gang started at once to clear up the mess and rebuild the chute. In about 3 shifts, the job was completed. From then on, I did not have any more trouble, having learned a good lesson at the expense of Kennecott Copper. I stayed on as a dozer man for another month. Then I asked for a transfer to the loading dock. As the spotted powder smoke kept giving me headaches, I was also transferred to this area. Loading the tramway buckets was an easy job and clean job compared to working deep down in the mine. The air was fresh, sometimes a little on the chilly side as the temperature in the winter dropped far below zero. The work we had to do was to fill the buckets with ore, then clamp them on the tram cable. at certain intervals. We also had to unload an freight coming up from Kennecott. The unloading was hard work at times, as buckets after buckets would be loaded with dynamite, drill steels, groceries, lumber, etc. And once in a while, a freight car with long timbers. The freight cars would be switched onto a side spur to be unloaded by another crew, as we had to keep the ore buckets going down the hill. There was a telephone line connecting us with the lower terminal, and if the buckets were not coming in regularly, the phone would jingle and a gruff voice inquire, "What is the matter up on the hill?" We would give our excuse, but I believe our explanation fell on dead ears most of the time. Then sometimes the lock holding the bucket onto the cable would come loose. Then the bucket would run wild, run into the next bucket, and so on until finally one would hold. Sometimes this would cause the tram to be down for several hours. No one ever got the blame for this. For this occurrence, and no one could tell why it happened. Then the first part of April 1925 came along, and we both got the spring fever. I said one day, "Well, we have been here now 7 months, and 7 months, and in 7 months, I had missed only one shift, Christmas Day. It was the only day the mine shut down during our time there. I heard they also shut down on the 4th of July. We then decided it was time to start for the interior, and as we now had our grub stake, go someplace and look for what we had come to Alaska for and find gold." That's the part of that. This is chapter 2. Leaving Kennecott the next day, we again rode the tram down to Kennecott. The departure felt like leaving home after living in the camp and the mine for 7 months. We had to stay in Kennecott the rest of the day, have a checkup at the hospital again, as we did going up to the mine, also to receive our final paycheck at the office. The train was late getting in the next day due to snow slides. Many slides and washouts occur on the railroad every spring, and the spring of 1925 was no exception. We again spent the night at Chitna. This time, when we arrived there, we felt like old sardos. After dinner that night, we sat and talked to Oscar Breedman, the roadhouse keeper. He had a lot of interesting stories to tell. Oscar had been in Alaska for many years, not only on the Copper River, but on some of the gold stampedes in the interior. The meals he served were far superior to what we were used to in the jumbo mine. In the jumbo mine, we had Chinese cooks, and I'm sure they could cook rice better than anything else. We had rice in some form every day. Also heard that the Chinamen had a contract to feed the men, and of course tried to serve meals as economically as possible. I remember one meal when one of the miners made a remark about the food and the Chinese in general. A great big Chinaman came out of the kitchen with a big butcher knife, and he was going to behead the complaining miner, and there was no fooling. Several miners jumped up, and after hitting the chink over the head with a big platter and knocking him out, someone threw the knife out the door and down in the gully. Both the miner and the chink were fired. It was late at night before we got to bed. At Chitna, Oscar liked to relate his experiences as much as we liked to hear them. The next morning, while having breakfast, we could hear the old steam locomotive wheezing outside the window, all set for the run to Cordova. On our trip up to Kenica, we had missed a lot of the scenery along the road due to low clouds in the Copper River Valley. But this time, leaving Chitna, it was clear and the scenery beautiful. There are two large glaciers close to the railroad. They are named Miles and Childs Glaciers. And the landscape is beautiful and as rugged as one would ever see. At least it looks that way to me from the comfort of a passenger car on the railroad. The speed of the train was not constant in any sense of the word. Sometimes it would travel at a speed as if possessed by the devil, and at other times creep along at a slow walk. We finally arrived at Cordova late in the afternoon. Checking at the office of the Alaska Steamship Company, we were told that the next boat for Seward, the SS Alameda, would not arrive for another 3 days. This did not hurt my feelings any, as there was many things to see in Cordova. The city of Cordova, as well as being the terminus of the Copper River Railroad, was at that time the greatest clam port in Alaska, also salmon fishing. I visited the canneries. It was real interesting. The days passed quickly, and then one morning, the SS Alameda was moored to the dock, due to sail north the same evening. We bought ferry tickets for Seward. The accommodations on the Alameda were a lot better than what we had experienced on our trip north. On board the steamer Northwestern. Some 7 months previous, there was a lot fewer passengers, and we were able to obtain lower bunks. The food also was far superior, and by offering a small bribe, we obtained some choice snacks between meals. At the end of that. Started out to have a look at the town. There
morning, they boarded the train for Anchorage in Fairbanks. Seward is a terminus of the Alaska Railroad. Therefore, the city is called a gateway to the interior. Sitting in the passenger car of the train, looking out the window, one cannot help but marvel at the feat of constructing this railroad. In places there is trestles, spanning gullies, hundreds of feet above the ground, and in other places, hairpin curves, where you can look straight down and see the rails below over which you have just traveled. Our layover at Anchorage was brief, just long enough to switch a few railroad cars. Anchorage in 1925 was just a small town, supported chiefly by the Alaska Railroad and the Evan Jones coal mine, also a few small mining camps in the surrounding area. Our overnight stop was at Curry Hotel, at a little place called Curry. This hotel was real plush in every way, good food and real nice rooms. But to Ira and I, the price seemed awfully high. The hotel is also owned and operated by the Alaska Railroad. That's enough for now. Leaving Curry the next morning, the whistle on the Loki started to blow. It kept on blowing and blowing. The train was slowing down and finally ground to a complete stop. The conductor happened to come by, so I asked him what the trouble was. He said there's a couple of moose on the railroad track right in front of the Loki, and the engineer is trying to get them to get off the road. But as the snow was deep, piled up on the sides of that railroad from the rotary in the winter, the moose could not get out. So, after a little bit, the train started up again, and it proceeded slowly along. The whistle was screaming, for soon be stopped again. But finally, after about an hour's time, the moose found a place where the snow wasn't so high, and they took off for the tall crush. Then from then on, we proceeded on up the road, and we stopped at noon at a little place called Healy. This is the Healy coal mine. It was at that time supplying most of the coal for the Alaska Railroad. It was owned by Captain Lathrop. Captain Lathrop was later killed by one of the railroad cars running over him at Healy. We had a real nice lunch, probably stopped for about an hour, and then we were on our way again, heading towards Leenana and Fairbanks. Sitting in the railroad car at Healy, looking out across the river, which is the Healy River, one could see the coal veins all through the sand or sandstones, and it seemed to be an awful lot of coal in the area. Well, we started on again and came up to Leenana, with a brief stop at Leenana, went on up to Fairbanks. Arnold and I got a small room at the Fairview Hotel, and the next morning we went out to see the town. We went in some of the places, business places and so on, and inquired about the possibilities of obtaining a lease on some mining ground or something in the neighborhood of Fairbanks. But as there was nothing there, we didn't know us exactly what to do. During the winter, we had talked about the Koyukuk. We had talked about Dawson and a lot of different places where gold mining was still going, but we had not definitely made up our mind what we were going to do. Fairbanks in 1925 was a real small little town. It was before the FE company decided to buy some ground there, and you might say that the town was dead. So after spending a couple of days in Fairbanks, we decided, well, we'll go on back down to Nenana, and then on down the river, and start out for Koyukuk. We felt pretty sure that we would find some place where we could at least do some prospecting. And if we had a few hundred dollars apiece, we didn't worry too much about a grub stake. We could spend the summer without doing any work or earning any money, if we had plenty to live on. So the next train, a couple of days, we went on back to Nenana and registered at the Cooney Hotel in Nenana. Mike Cooney, the owner of the hotel in Nenana, was quite a character. He was an old timer and had been in Alaska for many, many years. And he was a prospector and an all round worker. And he was also a wonderful cook. His wife was also a wonderful cook. She did most of the cooking in the hotel, but once in a while Mike would take a hand and help her out. So we stayed around the Nenana. We talked to a lot of the old timers. We visited the stores, Cargill store, Father and Morris's store, and lots of the old timers in Nenana. Nenana was then the terminus of the river boating down the Panama and Yukon River, and the boats, big boats, would go down as far as Marshall. There was the two big boats, Jeff Davis and General Jacobs. He also had a smaller boat. These were operated by the Alaska Railroad, and they were pushing big barges down the river. And that was about the only thing that supported Nenana, I believe, at that time, except little railroad work. Talking to some of the old timers in Nenana, we were told that down this manly hot springs in the Eureka country and Poppy country, Woodchopper, and around that vicinity, there was quite a bit of placer mining going on. And the old timers told us we thought it would be no problem for us to maybe get a piece of ground to work, or at least to do some prospecting. And if you wanted to, they felt pretty sure that you couldn't get a job for the summer. So after laying around Nenana for 2-3 days, we decided to take the winter trail and walk down as far as Sandy Hot Springs. Norton Commercial Company had a contract to carry the mail from Nenana as far as Panama. From Panama on down the river, the mail was carried by dog teams. The MC Company also had a number of stores along the way, and one at Manly Hot Springs and one at Panama, and they transported a lot of their supplies by the trail in the wintertime, especially produce and whatever fresh stuff that needs from the stores. So the old timers in Nenana told us that we wouldn't have any problems following the trail. No reason for being lost. If the trail was just as hard and wide as, you might say, a highway. storms came up, and the places covered the trail entirely. We found out later on when we became lost in the mental flat that we couldn't always take the old timer's word for anything. Well, anyway, we decided next morning to go over to Cargill's store and buy our ice that we needed for the trip. And we each bought an army blanket and a piece of canvas big enough to cover the, or to lay on, or else to cover us with. And we figured on spruce boss for a mattress. And we were really going to sidewash it on the trip. He had told us that if we stayed in the roadhouse, it would cost a lot of money. And we weren't about to spend any of our money, that's it, unless we absolutely had to. So we went in and we bought some rice, some dried apples, raisins. We didn't have coffee because it was too heavy. But we got some tea and sugar and a few odds and ends. And then Mrs. Cooney gave us two big loaves of bread, homemade bread. And we also bought some pilot bread. We also each had a rifle. I had a 32 carbine, and Ira had a 30-06 Springfield. So we started out. The packs weren't too heavy, and the going was real good when we left Enana. Of course, when we got down the trail a little ways, this was getting late in April, and the trail was getting soft. So we decided the only thing to do was to sleep during the day and then travel at night, because we generally froze for the heart at night. So this we did. Well, we got down below Nenana probably about 15 miles the first day, and then we made our camp in amongst the spruce trees. And the rabbits were real thick. There was rabbits hopping all over the trail. There was no problem getting rabbits. But it seemed to me that they were sick at that time, that particular time, and they were dying off. And you often found rabbits hanging in the willows where they jumped up and got caught in the branches and couldn't get away. Well, we didn't pay any attention to this. We figured it wasn't going to hurt us too much. For the first day, we shot a rabbit. And neither one of us had ever done any cooking. And we didn't know the first thing about cooking. So I was delegated to cook the first meal. So I said, "What are you going to cook?" Well, he says, "I'll cook some rice and we'll cook the rabbit." So we skinned this rabbit, we shot and quartered it up, put it in this little pot that we had for our cooking utensils. We had a frying pan, we had a couple of empty coffee cans, and one aluminum pot. Well, we put this water in this aluminum pot, and we put the rabbit in. Well, we cooked it down here over this campfire for hours and hours. And I said, when the rabbit is put in done, he's going to put some rice in there and make a real good stew. Well, we cooked and cooked this rabbit, and finally we thought it was fairly tender. So he pours in a couple of big cups of rice. Well, you never saw anything like it. The more it boiled, the more rice we had. We had rice in the frying pan. We had rice in the spare coffee can. We had rice in everything that we... I believe we even had some in our cap. Well, we finally got some of the rice cooked. And we proceeded to eat. All the rabbits was a long way from being done. And in rummaging around our supplies, we needed a little salt. Well, that's one thing we had forgotten to buy. We had also forgotten to buy some pepper. But anyway, hungry as we were, it tasted real good. And we had a big feed. And we fixed up our bed with one blanket and this canvas. Cut down some spruce boss and put the canvas on the spruce boss, and then laid down on the canvas and pulled the blankets over. And a big fire in between us. Well, whoever woke up first and was the coldest, he's the one that's supposed to replenish the fire. pretty good sized pile of wood before we retired. Well, I laid in bed there and I was cold on one side. The side towards the fire was nice and warm, but the other side was freezing. Well, I thought maybe Harry was to save. Maybe I could play possum here and maybe he'd go up and fix the fire. Well, I laid there as long as I could, but I finally stopped. There's no use for both of us laying there freezing to death, so I got up and I fixed up the fire. Then I thought, well, next time it'd be his turn. Well, I finally went to sleep after fixing the fire and got the other side of me warm. And then about, oh, I would say about 4 o'clock in the morning, I heard Iris carrying on out there and he was making tea. We had forgotten to get coffee, or else we didn't want him to take a coffee on account of the weight. So he was making tea for breakfast. So we had a cup of tea and a couple of hardtacks, maybe a slice of bread, and then we started on the trail again. Well, that night we got as far as Johnny Campbell's Roadhouse. It's about 51 miles from Indiana, so we had a real long walk that day. And we were pretty tired, and I said to Ireland, well, let's stop in the roadhouse for the night. Well, he says, okay. So we stopped in Johnny Campbell's Roadhouse. I figured we'd probably get a good night's sleep. Well, I'm sure glad to be, because Johnny Campbell, he was quite a character. He's an old-timer, and he had a lot of experience, and he was telling stories. And we sat there and talked and talked and talked till way after midnight. And we finally decided that we better get some sleep if we're going to hit the trail in the morning. Then we decided, no, we're going to stay there the next day, spend all day at Johnny Campbell's, and then head out the next night. So we did, and we had a real good rest. So then the next evening, the moon was shining bright. Of course, it was almost 24-hour daylight by then. We started out for Tolovana, which was the next roadhouse. We had no intention of stopping the roadhouse, of course, but we thought we might. Well, anyway, we started out and we got in the Minto Flat. And during the winter, the snow got so deep that the stage drivers had to make frequent detours. In other words, you came to a big snow drift and the horses couldn't go through the drift. So you'd make a road round, and then a storm come up and recover this road. So anyway, we got in on the road there, and I said to Ira, I said, we're getting further and further away from the river. And the guy said, it looks that way to me too. He said, we must be on the wrong trail. We went on just a little bit further, and then we found a real good dog trail. It must have been dozens of dog teams over this trail. Real good going. And we felt good, no, we finally got the trail now. We kept on going for about 3-4 hours, making good time, probably about 3-4 miles an hour. And we came to a great big lake out in the woods, and there must have been a dozen natives. And they were on these little houses on the lake, which we later found out that they were muskrat houses. And we had gotten way out in the Minto Flats where the natives were catching muskrats in the spring of the year. So we went up to one old squaw there and said, asked her if this was the right trail to Manly Hot Springs. So she said, ooh, ooh. One of us knew to talk to her because she apparently didn't speak English. So we went to the next one, the same thing. But finally we found a fellow there that was a bit younger generation, and he said, no, he says, you're way off, you're way out in the Minto Swamp. You have to go clear back to the river. Go back the way you come and then turn to your left and you'll hit the mail trail again. So we lost the whole night. Just lost the whole night just walking into this lake. Well, we went a little bit back a little bit on the trail and then we finally made camp and thought we'd wait, rest up a little bit, and then hit the trail again the next evening. which we did. Then we, after spending a real unpleasant day, you might say, cold as it was, wet, so on, got a few hours sleep, and we built up the fire big enough so we could dry our clothing, and then we were all set for the trail again the next night. So we walked all that night, made good time, and we had found the old horse trail again. Then we camped. In the morning, we're going to camp now, and we get to Sullivan's loadout sometime tomorrow, or tomorrow night. So we camped, and the next evening we started out, and we just rounded one bend in the trail, probably about 1,000 feet from where we had camped, and right beyond that bend was Sullivan's Roadhouse. We had stepped within a quarter of a mile of the roadhouse. I might mention here that the evening before we started out, when we found the roadhouse, Ira had made some tea. And as I said before, the rabbits were thicker than fleas. There were thousands of them all over. And of course, the snow that you used for tea was not too clean. So I remarked to Ira this particular evening, I said, Ira, do you want to put more tea in the can than you usually do? No, he's not put the same amount. It's just figured for about 4 cups of tea. And he said, it should be about right. Well, I said, it's dark, and it tastes a lot stronger. But he said, it seems that way to me, too. He said, I can't understand it. Well, we didn't find out until after we emptied the tea crumbs out of the pot that there was a layer of rabbit droppings in the bottom of the can. When he scooped up the snow to make the tea, of course, he'd run into one of those little piles of rabbit droppings. And, like I said, the bottom of the can was just covered with. Of course, this wasn't the last time it happened, because it happened several times later on, but the quantity was not quite as great, but the quality was almost the same. We decided to stop at the Sullivan Roadhouse and have one square meal, as we really needed. The roadhouse at Sullivan was then ran by a fellow named Harry Martin and his wife, and she was Scandinavian and a real good cook. So we stopped in the roadhouse and she fixed us up with a big, what at that time would be dinner, because it was in the evening. And I remember we had moose steaks and all the trimmings. And then after resting around there for a couple of hours, we hit the trail again on our way towards Manly Hot Springs. That's all for now. By now the weather was getting pretty warm, and it didn't freeze at night, and the going was pretty slow. But finally, after stopping one night at the Dugan Creek Roadhouse, we finally arrived at Manly Hot Springs, wet and hungry, and checked in at the Dan Green's Roadhouse. This was to be our home till after the breakup of the Tanana River. And was never rebuilt. the freight coming into Manly Hot Springs, it landed at the Tanana or River, what they call the Hot Springs Landing, then hauled overland for about 2.5-3 miles with horse teams into the town of Manly Hot Springs. There is no mining in Hot Springs or close by. The mining camps are situated within a 30-mile radius of Hot Springs, namely Eureka, Topsy, Woodchopper, American Creek, and of course this is what supports the town of Manly Hot Springs. Manly Hot Springs Telephone Exchange, at that time owned by Ant Tillotson, was one of the main sources of news for the district. The phone was being media of reporting, traveling in the vicinity was also the only way people on the creek could keep abreast with the news, but there was no radio. At that time, gossip was picked up as well as news. When the phone rang, as they were all on a party line, you could hear every receiver on the line click. And there was absolutely no chance for anybody telling any secrets over this line, because everybody in the vicinity heard the news. The phone line ran from Manly Hot Springs to Tanana, from Tanana to Eureka, and from Hot Springs up the line to Nanaimo. Wagon road connected Manly Hot Springs to Eureka, and there was also some sort of a road going over to Topsy and Woodchopper. This road was fairly good in the summer and in the dry weather, but in the wet season it was nothing but rust and almost impossible for horses and wagons to get over. It was maintained by the Alaska Road Commission, and not too much work was done on this road, as there wasn't much money for the purpose. In the summer of 1925, there was 8 or 10 small mining operations at Manly Hot Springs, or in the vicinity of Eureka. The largest office being G.R. Frank. They were all hydraulic mining. And at Topsy and Woodchopper, there was about half a dozen different office mining. A couple of offices on larger scale, but mostly small individuals. And the output of gold, or the recovery of gold, was not too great, as most of the mines for low grade proposition, all open cut mining. In 1925, there was probably about 50 people living right in Hot Springs proper, and probably the same amount on the outlying creek. But the population was not too great. The ice jammed below the mouth of the Hot Springs Slough during the breakup of the Tanana River. The water backed up and flooded